This process continued after Disney's death in 1966, but an important event took place in 1995. While nearly 70 years have passed since the production of Disney's traditional 2D animations, and a year before the animation of The Lion King was able to sell more than $430 million at the box office and receive an Oscar award, a 3D animation challenged Walt Disney's dreams. Toy Story was produced by Pixar and under Steve Jobs' supervision. This animation attracted all the viewers. It must be mentioned that Pixar wasn't a very famous company at that time, so Pixar became a serious competitor for Walt Disney. However, Walt Disney executives decided to be in charge of the release of Toy Story in cinemas exclusively. Walt Disney's partnership with Pixar continued until 2006. The more important thing is that there are no more competitors. Just like Monopoly board game, Walt Disney rolls the dice like a winner in this game. The rest of the players have to continue playing and pay their rent.
Today, the Justice Department's antitrust division approved a huge purchase. Disney is buying up most of 21st Century Fox's assets. This is a $71 billion deal. The decision comes after Disney upped its offer this morning for Fox's movie studio, sports networks, and cable channels.
In Monopoly board game, one player precedes the others and starts to purchase houses and hotels. This process reaches a point that this player's properties become so big. From then on, whenever he rolls the dice, one of the players goes bankrupt. Finally, after a few rounds of the game, everyone is forced to sell his property to the monopolist and say goodbye to the competition. No one has committed a crime, and apparently everything is legal. Throughout the game, everyone competes fairly. The result of the game is the formation of a monopoly. During the Cold War and even after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a difference of opinion between the supporters of the socialist and capitalist economy, and they had to deal with this question: which system is better for people? In socialist system, there is no competition between factories, and there is not supposed to be any better one. In this situation, the consumer is always harmed by the low quality of the products. In the capitalist system, competition is the main issue. In this situation, everyone should try hard to produce a better product at a lower price and take over the market. It seems that consumers always win in this market, although this is only the appearance of this economy. But behind the scenes of the capitalist economy, they are the owners of the companies who get the main profit. In capitalism, not everyone is supposed to be the boss, and there are only a few big bosses and everyone else works for them. When we talk about Japan, we think about technology, audio, and video equipment. We also think about streets with large screens and high-speed internet, and also people who are always busy with their cell phones. But in Japan, apart from IT and high-tech products, other things are also made, which have a history richer than such products. YKK has been producing zippers since 1934. This Japanese company produces more than 7 billion zippers in different types every year and owns almost half of the world market. Zippers may be considered an unimportant commodity for many of us, and it is better to mention another example to understand monopoly better. This example takes us to Milan in Italy. This city is famous for fashion and expensive clothes. Milan reminds us of its two football clubs and the San Siro Stadium. However, Milan is the monopolistic center of sunglasses in the world. Luxottica designs and then retails more than 80% of all sunglasses brands in the world. Luxottica designs all kinds of brands such as Ray-Ban, Oakley, Prada, and Versace. Of course, people around the world do not know the reality and think that each pair of these glasses are made in different countries. However, it may not matter much to the people of the world who makes zippers and sunglasses. But it is definitely important who provides the food we need. Tyson is one of these companies that focuses on the supply and distribution of meat in the United States of America. Approximately 25% of the white and red meat of the United States is sold by this company. Tyson is so big that accusations against it have never reached any results. In 2017, it became known that this company uses a kind of antibiotic in the diet of chickens. In the beginning, this story went viral in social media and news agencies. But after only a few weeks, everything returned to normal and nobody followed the issue anymore. It is not in anyone's interest to fall out with Tyson. In fact, in today's world, apart from well-known tech giants such as Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and Amazon, whose monopolies have been in the headlines for a long time, simpler products such as zippers, glasses, meat, and many other ones are only made by one or more large companies. This is why no one can fall out with them. But monopoly is not seen only in the market of consumer products. This phenomenon occurs behind very obvious events every day in front of the eyes of millions of viewers. The miracle of Camp Nou in 1999 changed many things in the world of football. Until then, many of us had not heard the word comeback. We didn't know the value of the final seconds until Teddy Sheringham and Ole Gunnar Solskjaer scored against Bayern Munich. It was from that moment that the Bavarians realized that they had to change their minds about football. Since that year, Bayern Munich has won 16 of the 21 Bundesliga seasons. This famous football club received these titles like drinking a glass of water. In the 80s and 90s, Germans allowed football stars like Jürgen Klinsmann, Lothar Matthäus, and Andreas Brehme to play in foreign football clubs. From 2000 onwards, Bayern Munich did not allow any team to think about recruiting German stars. By spending huge amounts of money in each football season, the CEOs of Bayern Munich chose only the best players of the other teams and did not think about picking and training new talents. It wasn't long before all the teams in Bundesliga were competing for the second place in the table. They knew that with good results, their players would go to Bayern Munich with tempting offers. The CEOs of Bayern Munich believed that you should score so many goals against a weak team that they forget about playing football again. UEFA's financial fair play rules were approved in 2010. One of the main goals of these rules was to prevent monopoly in football. According to this law, clubs do not have the right to spend more money than their income. And this prevents the injection of excessive financial resources or financial doping. However, many critics believe that UEFA's financial fair play not only does not break the monopoly of big football powers, but on the contrary, it is a tool in the hands of the old clubs to stand against the newly emerging and wealthy powers such as Paris Saint-Germain FC and Manchester City FC. These types of events in the world of football happen in Monopoly Board Game 2. In this game, an experienced player plays with some inexperienced children and defeats everyone at the very beginning. Will these children play Monopoly again? When you're working on computer and surfing the net, you may not ask yourself why internet browsers are free. You probably think that free internet browsers show the benevolence and generosity of tech companies and even people like Bill Gates. But behind the scenes of these seemingly simple events, complex actions take place.
Netscape Navigator, software which makes it easy for people to connect the global computer network called the Internet.
Netscape Navigator was the king of web browsers at the time. But there was a downside. You had to pay $49 to install Netscape on your computer.
In one of the most important antitrust law cases of 1996 in America, Microsoft, the information technology giant, was accused of providing Internet Explorer for free. Because apparently by doing a customer-oriented action, Microsoft had removed its smaller but more successful competitor, Netscape, from the competition scene.
The DOJ argued that Microsoft stifled competition by using its sheer size to barge into the browser wars. It could offer Internet Explorer for free, included in the OS, and Netscape would be cut out of the business from the very first time the computer was turned on. On top of that, if a person wanted to install Netscape on the computer, Microsoft allegedly made it incredibly difficult to do so. Microsoft, on the other hand, argued that people chose to use its operating system because it was simply better than the competition.
This monopolistic action of Microsoft showed how complicated and deceptive the behavior of huge companies can be in destroying competitors. Chance is one of the two types of card drawing spaces in Monopoly. If you enter the space, you pick one chance card and follow the order. Receiving money from the bank or paying a fine to the bank or anything else are written on the chance cards. In the game, the type of card chosen is completely random. But in the real world, random selection is not attractive because company managers do not like to be surprised. They prefer to advance their work in any way by helping their government financially or by doing humanitarian work. In the summer of 2020, the CEOs of the four American tech giants were summoned to the congressional hearing for the umpteenth time. Jeff Bezos, executive chairman of Amazon, Sundar Pichai, the CEO of Google, Mark Zuckerberg, Chief Executive Officer of Facebook, and Tim Cook, Chief Executive Officer of Apple. They were supposed to answer the questions of the U.S. congressman about eliminating small competitors and creating a monopoly. This meeting was held virtually due to COVID-19 pandemic and lasted about 5 hours. But this meeting was fruitless. The CEOs of these companies talked about their hard lives in childhood and youth, and then talked about their contribution to the economic prosperity of the United States of America.
The products we build have changed the world and improved people's lives. Our industry is one of the ways that America shares its values with the world, and one of our greatest economic and cultural exports. Facebook is part of this story. we started with an idea to give people the power to share and connect. And we've built services that billions of people find useful. I'm proud that we've given people who've never had a voice before the opportunity to be heard.
Tim Cook claimed that Apple's App Store alone contributed $138 billion to the U.S. market. Mark Zuckerberg talked about the help of Facebook in connecting the people of the world to each other, and when he was asked why he also bought Instagram in 2012, he said, "I never thought that this social networking system would become popular at that time." Finally, the CEOs of these four companies, whose capital is $5 trillion in total, finished the congressional hearing and nothing special happened, just like the previous meetings. Sundar Pichai still owns the world with Android. Jeff Bezos still destroys his competitors with online retail. Mark Zuckerberg still controls the world's communications with Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram. Tim Cook does not allow any competitor to get close to Apple products. These tech giants are so much big that no one can compete with them. These small companies are like the poor bankers in Monopoly board game that can't compete with powerful players. The banker is probably company's cooperator in this game.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a very interesting question, and that question is related to a topic which is one of the virtues within Islam. I'm speaking, of course, of the recitation of the Holy Quran, Tilawatul Quran. As you know, the Quran is the book of God, it is the book of Muslims, and all Muslims learn the Quran and are taught to recite it, they recite it ever since they're children. But like every good act, this good act, it has certain etiquettes. And today on The Key, we want to look and examine and ask, what are the etiquettes of the recitation of the Holy Quran? So let's look at this topic by taking inspiration from the hadith which have been narrated regarding this topic. In one beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that the Holy Prophet said, "Clean the path of the Quran." He was asked, "O Messenger of Allah, and what is the path of the Quran?" He replied, "Your mouths." They asked, "How should we clean them?" He said, "By brushing them with a cleanser, a siwak, a toothbrush." Right, so one of the etiquettes of the Holy Quran, of reciting the Holy Quran, is that when we recite the Holy Quran, we should brush our teeth before we do so. Right? Another etiquette of reciting the Holy Quran, which we are all aware of, is that we should seek refuge in God when we recite the Holy Quran. In the Holy Quran itself, God mentions this and alludes to this when he says, when you recite the Quran, seek the protection of God against the outcast, Satan. فَإِذَا قَرَعْتَ الْقُرْآنَ فَاسْتَئِذْ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ. And Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said, when he was asked about seeking refuge at the beginning of every chapter, he said, yes, seek refuge in God from the outcast, Satan. And he mentioned that the outcast is the most wicked of Satans. In another verse of the Holy Quran, we read one of the other etiquettes of reciting the Holy Quran, and that is that we should recite the Holy Quran in a measured tone. Allah says, وَرَتِّلِ الْقُرْآنَ تَرْتِيلًا. Recite the Quran in a measured tone. And the Holy Prophet said, with respect to this verse, he said, recite it clearly, meaning this, he interpreted this verse in this way. Recite it clearly. Do not disperse it prosaically, nor rave it like raving poetry. Meaning it's not poetry. It should be recited slowly, but not too slowly, in a measured way. Stop where it mentions wonders and move the hearts with it. And do not let your only concern be to finish the end of the chapter. Right? Sometimes we get preoccupied with finishing what we're reading of the Holy Quran. We want to get to, you know, a certain point, and we hurriedly recite it. So this is incorrect, and we should try to avoid doing this. Another etiquette of reciting the Holy Quran is contemplation or tadabbur. In one verse of the Holy Quran, we read, it is a blessed book that we have sent down to you so that they may contemplate its signs and that those who possess intellect may take admonition. So the contemplation of the verses of the Holy Quran, this is another etiquette that should be observed while reciting it. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the etiquettes of the Holy Quran in light of its verses and the hadith of the infallibles. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
The earth and the heavens begin to sing. The angels celebrate the birth of a king. A king who outshines the stars of the night. A beacon of hope. You guide us with your love. It's a fountain of love.
that quenches the thirst of every broken heart. A piece of paradise in this desert land. Oh yeah, with grace and kindness you fill our empty blessings of God upon you is my prayer. The earth and the heavens begin to sing. This day we celebrate the birth of a king.
They say that a barking dog doesn't bite. But Mr. Donald Trump, if I may use the metaphor, has been barking at Mexico for quite some time. Could we be on the verge of witnessing military invasion of Mexico by the Americans? So buckle up, because this is today's journey on Gringo.
Así empezamos, Gringo.
The Secretary of State is saying that we're very close to a deal in the Middle East.
We've been talking about this I have as a guest the foreign media correspondent here in Mexico, Raúl Torres, whom I warmly welcome. Raúl, it's such a pleasure to see you again and to have you here on Gringo. And we have a satellite connection here with Samuel Cruz Trujillo, a historian and analyst with an excellent YouTube channel, author of several books, and also a Mexican who lives in La Paz, Bolivia, to ask him about this topic. I'm really glad to have you back here at Gringo. Raúl, regarding Claudia Sheinbaum, it's quite unique because with Trump, it seemed like he and Andrés Manuel López Obrador had a mutual understanding. However, with Claudia Sheinbaum on one hand, he praises her personally. He says she is intelligent and all these good words. But on the other hand, Mexico is still struggling. There is a double standard at play, you know? The president of Mexico, Claudia Sheinbaum, has mentioned several times, well, there is the national anthem, a soldier in every son you gave. A soldier, you see, we're talking about a narrative, a use of language.
Narrativa, un uso del lenguaje.
Da la impresión de que el presidente Trump.
Well, to me, it's like President Trump speaks to the president, probably with his head turned to the left or to his left side. But then when he talks about her, he speaks with his right hand. I mention this because he has indeed expressed positive remarks about her. Yet he concludes by saying, she can't, she's even afraid. However, he has gone further. As you may recall that just a few weeks ago, there was a report of a warship sailing very close to Ensenada, in international waters, but near Ensenada. Weeks later, it was reported that a surveillance plane from the United States was circling over Mexican territory, specifically in the northern part of the country. In addition, during the attacks carried out near Venezuela, we have witnessed how the narco boats are targeted and destroyed, resulting in the loss of lives.
Without any proof whatsoever that they are drug traffickers, nothing.
And without the basic right for these individuals to defend themselves. Well, there was also a case where even the Mexican Navy took part in the search for lone survivor of U.S. strikes on alleged drug boats.
Euphemistically called a castaway. Well, a castaway, but after an attack.
Of course. It wasn't in Mexican waters, but rather in international waters, close to Mexican waters. The Mexican government assisted in the search for this individual, this possible survivor, who was not found. So President Trump makes these statements. But then he pressures the Mexican government to take certain actions, even though the president asserts that we are sovereign, which we are, despite her claims that she governs independently of President Trump's pressure. However, in February and then in August, she handed over a total of 56 drug traffickers, who were indeed drug traffickers and criminals, but were undergoing legal proceedings and some still had time to appeal, to seek to avoid extradition. The Mexican government essentially decides to exile them, citing a security law. So it ends like this, bending the government, making President Sheinbaum take decisions and actions that she probably wouldn't take at another time or under different circumstances. If we talk about a matter of sovereignty, she shouldn't have to do it, yet she does.
Well, you've experienced Trump's first term, and you were quite active here in Mexico. What differences do you see between that first term of Trump, moving through Biden, and now in the second term of Donald Trump?
I believe he is a much more aggressive president now. In those earlier days of his first term, it seemed like there was room for negotiation, at least with Mexico. I think he has adopted a much more assertive approach, driven by a need for people to truly believe in him, and understandably so, given his recent electoral setback. Therefore, I think this leads him to make decisions that are much tougher and face stronger opposition than what the government encountered during his previous term.
Samuel, as a historian, you can say whatever you like, but I can't help but recall that excuse, that pretext used by President James Polk in 1846 to invade Mexico. It even promoted the young legislator Abraham Lincoln to ask, "What? What's going on? Bloodshed on Mexican soil?" With so many justifications for invasion and intervention, do you see that risk right now? Is there any false flag operation? Something that could lead to, "Wow, you did this to me, so let's go and take action." Because this all begins with labeling organized crime groups as terrorists.
Well, I should say yes. Let's not forget that the United States is, well, along with Israel, the masters of false flag operations. I must confess that when we were on one of their shows, we were watching a video that described the Sonora Desert as Afghanistan. That makes it clear to me that the plan is in place. In fact, there have always been invasion plans, not just against Mexico, but against other countries as well. They claim to have dismantled drug cartels after World War II, but believing the United States when they say they're going to dismantle that is truly insane. In fact, the United States thrives on that. I used to think it could happen when the elements from the United States, who were supposedly going to support the Mexican forces in the fight against drug trafficking, came in. But now I'm feeling fear regarding Israel, with the recent news of an alleged attempt by Iran to assassinate the Israeli ambassador in Mexico. I believe that's where the issues might arise, and if not, at least the ambassador is making an impression on the president regarding what they might be negotiating. However, all of this aligns with Donald Trump's rhetoric. This is very much in line with the recent performance that Israel staged in Mexico, where we can clearly see that Israel's influence is becoming more apparent. Previously, it operated somewhat under the radar, we could say, in a subtle, economic, rhetorical, and propagandistic manner. But now, there is a real risk that if a false flag operation occurs in Mexico, we could be pushed to align directly with Israel and the United States. Remember, as we mentioned, while there was a struggle, Sheinbaum acknowledged that what was happening in Gaza was genocide. Additionally, Mexico was one of the countries that voted for a ceasefire, while only the United States, Israel, and Argentina voted against it. So I also don't rule out the possibility of either diplomatic pressure or a false flag attack occurring.
Diplomática o un ataque de falsa bandera.
Bien, oye, entonces, ¿tú consideras...
Well, so do you think that the possibility of this is just a heads up about something that might be brewing and could eventually be used as a false flag operation? Let's not forget that two Israelis were arrested who intended to blow up the legislative palace of San Lazaro, which is the seat of the Chamber of Deputies in Mexico, and after that, there was complete silence. So, a false flag operation. On that topic, I ask you, what would happen here in Mexico if there were an invasion, perhaps not like the previous ones? Would the Mexican army send a soldier for every son, as President Claudia Sheinbaum says?
¿Entraría el ejército mexicano un soldado en cada hijo te dio, como dice la presidenta Claudia Sheinbaum?
Pues yo creo que sí. Los mexicanos somos así.
I believe that yes, we Mexicans are like that. I think the army would obviously take the lead, but unfortunately, let me be very blunt about this, it would be the same as what has happened all over the world. We can be very brave or very bold, but the Afghans, the Gazans, and other countries that have been subjugated are also very brave and bold. So we couldn't know. Look, I prefer to think of a diplomatic solution. I wouldn't even dare to think about it. Just now, Mr. Rawl mentioned that plane that flew over Baja California, over the Sea of Cortez, or the Gulf of California, as some call it, and that plane passed right in front of the city where I was born. The feeling of awe is indescribable. Now, to think about a war is something I wouldn't even dare to comment on, but undoubtedly, we Mexicans would get involved. However, the examples from around the world are quite disappointing, making it hard to say we should go to war with the United States. I believe the Mexican government should, or rather must, find a way to resolve the issue without making so many excuses, as it seems they are trying hard to give the impression that they are indeed colluding with drug trafficking.
Raúl,
recently a mayor was murdered in the city of Uruapan, Michoacán. This mayor had a background as a congressman and was making significant waves from Uruapan, Michoacán, generating a whole movement. I am almost certain he would have won the upcoming elections on the 27th to become the governor of Michoacán. And many do not rule out the possibility of him moving on to the presidency. He had a very different approach to confronting organized crime, using a language that contrasts sharply with that of the Fourth Transformation. This assassination is certainly not music to the ears of Mr. Donald Trump, as they say. Just look, could there be something unusual going on? I don't know, I really don't, but without diving into speculation, because journalism is about covering facts, not hypotheses, it seems to fit perfectly into building that narrative. I return to the book by Caspar Weinberger. Please read it. It discusses a country descending into chaos, necessitating U.S. intervention to restore order. Honestly, that thought frightens me.
Honestly, I hadn't considered the assassination of Mayor Manso from a geopolitical perspective. I viewed it more as a conflict and all the events it has triggered, along with the potential repercussions for the country. However, it's quite fascinating because, in the end, it does draw a parallel to Donald Trump. In other words, they can't. And we need to pay attention to the statement from General Secretary Trevilla, who said it wasn't an issue. It wasn't because of the protocol.
Yes, we didn't fail. He almost blames the dead man.
Yes, of course. So when General Trevilla states that it wasn't a protocol issue, meaning it wasn't a problem with my guys, my soldiers, then it becomes someone else's problem. If it's someone else's problem, why are they trying to resolve it? Why are they covering for this individual who was well known to be under siege, to be in danger? Therefore, it was undoubtedly a serious mistake on the part of the National Guard and the military. Let's consider that perhaps Carlos Manso was indeed careless, but that's why he had all that military escort. In other words, the army failed. The army couldn't handle the criminals.
A whole movement is being created, including nationwide protests, to which an organization called Generation Z is adding its call. What do you think about that? Also, there are the old rumors about plans for the balkanization of Mexico, particularly in the northern part, and then everything else, including the southeast and what Trump once referred to as the Central America area, which he called a bunch of holes.
Hoyos de mierda, así dijo él.
Siempre ha habido también dentro, o sea, tampoco hay que solamente ver.
There have always been internal enemies as well, so we shouldn't only look outward. The dangers from within are quite serious, Mr. Rubain. The factions that always exist, even within the same parties, have significant power in Mexico and are not hesitant to betray or to call for foreign forces to enter our territory. I'm going to be quite blunt again, but one of those who did this was Benito Juarez, that figure we are made to worship, almost like a god in elementary school. However, if it weren't for the Americans, he would have given away a passage. They rejected his plan to permanently hand over a passage through the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, and another from Nogales to Guaymas, Sonora. If it were up to him, we would already be balkanized.
I'm very grateful, and I hope to see you on the next episode of Gringo.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Good afternoon to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio. Greetings from Tehran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. Muslim scholar Ibn al-Haytham, known as Al-Hazen in Europe, who was born in 965 AD, formulated the scientific method and has been referred to as the world's first true scientist. He is also often regarded as the first theoretical physicist, making a significant contribution to the theory of light and optics. Additionally, he developed what is called celestial mechanics, which led to the eventual work of Europeans such as Copernicus, Galileo, Johannes Kepler, and Isaac Newton. We'll listen to the continuation of Iran Radio. Thank you for joining us. We start off this hour's programs with Youth Station, a program all about young people and dealing with topics related to youth. Next is Israel Watch. The program critically analyzes Zionist media reports about the current events and issues in the West Asia region. That will be followed by Back to Reality. In this roundtable discussion, young Muslims are invited to discuss some pertinent religious and social issues of today's Islamic world. Our varied radio productions feature will be next.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islam, my deen. Allah, my Lord. His word, Quran. Muhammad, Prophet. Praise be upon him. I am Muslim for all of time.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. السلام علیکم to all of you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Youth Station. This is Nahid having the honor of being with you. And here with me I have the honor of being with my very dear brother
Muhammad. And assalamu alaikum to everyone listening to us. We were talking in a very recent episode about our expectations from our parents. How do we expect our parents to be? And what happens when our parents don't meet our expectations? And we did discuss a lot about education, about demanding from our parents, and what happens if our demands are not met, and what happens when they're met, especially in this technological era. But I think we should also address a very fundamental issue, Sister Nahid, and I think that is self-centrism. When we look ourselves as ourselves and no one else other than ourselves,
the center of the world.
Exactly. That becomes a very dangerous line between ourselves and parents. And I've experienced this a lot. Whenever your parents scold you, especially as a kid growing up, not so much in the youth arena, but more when you're, you know, towards, like, you come back and when you're like alone and you think, why do they hate me? As if you're the only one who exists and no one else exists, and you see your world from your own eyes and no one else's. You keep telling yourself, why do they hate me? What do you think is the remedy to this?
Well, you know, first of all, I thinking about this being in the center of the world, we usually talk about the negative part of it. But I myself, in my own experience, have seen both the positive and negative sides. Sometimes, regarding the rest, I mean, this Gen Z members, we Gen Z members, learn this, and it's really sweet that we learn that we don't have to be accepted by the whole world. And I really love this part of us. I mean, outside in the society, when someone just criticizes us, tells us negative opinion, we don't care because we feel like I am responsible for my own life. But when it comes to the home, when it comes to the family, I think the problem arises here. The thing that I have seen with my own friends or even the younger children these days is that they do the same in the family as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when I was a teenager, I used to go to many different classes and different places. And this was my parents' scenario. Now I'm learning this. Now I'm just seeing it. That they wanted me to see different groups of people, to learn to be sociable, since in the family we have a small family. Mm-hmm. So it was only me and my brother. So they sent us to different classes so we can learn how to be more sociable. Mm-hmm. And I learned there in a society that I don't have to care about the other people's opinion. But once we came home, we had this framework of family. And the family...
And you have to care about their opinion.
Yeah, and their opinion matters. Here you are not supposed to say, okay, I'm drawing a line around myself. This is the circle. Nobody can enter. No, it's not. It's nothing like that. In the family, the framework changes. But this misunderstanding, I think, is bothering the new generation.
I think it really kind of conflicts whereby you have your own opinion and your parents have their opinion. And that's on one side of the coin. The other side of the coin, you have to consider that, okay, they're my parents. They brought me up. They gave birth to me. They fed me. They protected me. And they did all sorts of sacrifices.
And right now,
selflessly.
They're not going to harm me.
Exactly. And you're thinking, okay, if my opinion is the correct one, why aren't they accepting it? Why is there a problem from the? If they still do love me, why don't they still consider the things that I love, or the things that I think are the correct, my correct decisions? Why don't they support me, just like before? No, I think this conflict can be easily resolved when you see your parents as responsible but not flawless. Your parents are responsible.
Right.
When they tell you some things, whether it be their advice in your purchases, in your buying habits, in your educational career, in your family career, when you want to select a spouse, when you're going towards all of these stages, when they're advising from a parent's lens, from the parent's eyes. And they're advising because they see that it's their responsibility. Not only is it their, legal or paralegal responsibility, but also their emotional responsibility. They have brought you up. They've gone through so many emotions with you. They have seen you cry and they have, you know.
So true.
Exactly. So they see that, okay, since we've gone through so much, I should not leave this child just like that. when you keep that in mind, you also have to understand they're not flawless. They're not infallible. Yes, they might advise you. They might advise you good. They might advise you bad. But then they're not flawed. They're not infallible.
Yeah, it's you to make the decision. You don't have to copy whatever.
Let's change the phrase from you expecting something from the parents, and let's see it from their expectations. They expect you to become a doctor. It's a very common thing among parents. They have high expectations. They expect you to become someone successful. That's why when they tell you take this educational path rather than the other one that you were thinking is. Take science instead of arts. Take business instead of this and that. They are seeing the success in you. They are seeing that, okay, I know what's good for this child because I've brought him up. And this conflict can be resolved by considering that, oh, they might not be flawless. And on the other hand, maybe you are in the wrong side as well. Right. Take a step back.
You know, when I think of myself as a parent in the future, it looks really scary to me. I mean, I feel the danger there that normally speaking, I would want the best things for my own child. But what if I will be wrong as well? So whenever I try to understand the perspective of parents, of my own parents, I just think of myself in their position. Once I experience this feeling, this vibe, I'm really scared. I don't know if it's the same with you or not, but I feel scared. I mean, the only word that I can use is scared of the future decisions, of the things that I feel my child will succeed in, and the opposite. What if I want something for them and it will not happen? It will never happen.
I think that really does justice to that feeling, the word fear.
Yeah.
Yes, it is fearful. I mean, many of us as youths, if we think about our future, our kids, and then we apply that same thinking between our parents. What our parents are going through now or what they went through when they were telling us and they were not reaching our expectations. I think that really applies to our parents. They would have been also fearless and anxious about us as maybe the future.
But they acted brave.
Yeah, they did. And I think it's also expected of us as youths to our children now to act as bravely as our parents or even more braver. And with that, I think let's take a break and we'll come back. Don't go away. You're listening to The Youth Station and we're talking about parents. Don't go away. We have a lot more to talk about.
This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back, and we are talking about the perspectives of parents versus children with all their needs and wants and expectations. We need the parents and children to sit together, to start to talk, to share the kinds of fear, the things in their mind, their mindset. In this way, I mean, we say we're in the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have improved, we should act like the improved versions of human beings, not those who have copied.
More civilized and more cultured, who can have a dialogue without conflict.
But unfortunately, sometimes it's not happening. Sometimes we're just fighting each other. We're not listening to each other well.
I think that aspect of respecting parents, and this is something I have to thank my parents again for this, because whenever I would disrespect my mother, my father would come in and scold me and treat me the way I should be treated and you know, guide me towards respecting my mother. And likewise, when I disrespect my father, my mother would come in. And this kind of two-sided enforcement of respect really got us to the point that we see even using their names or even calling them in a very bad tone as really disrespectful, and we have red lines for that. We don't basically we don't become stupidly angry at our parents because of that respect. My father would say, "Why did you do this?" I would just put my head down and accept, even though what I did was the correct thing, right? And I know that maybe even reality was correct, but then that respect is there. And I think this is something that is enforced by the Quran, and may God bless the parents who have, brought up their kids respecting the Quran, because when the parents bring their kids in a way that the kids respect Quran, they respect them. Why? Because the Quran itself says that be grateful to your parents. And this being grateful comes directly after being grateful to God Almighty.
Yeah.
God Almighty says,
mentioned.
Exactly. I can remember in chapter 31, Surah Luqman of the Quran, in verse number 14 and 15, it talks about how you should be grateful to God Almighty and then to your parents directly after that. And then it tells you that even if they are not grateful, they are not respectful to you, if they did push you towards something wrong, you don't do that wrong thing, but be respectful.
Right.
Be respectful. Be respectful. And I think this should be incorporated in our thinking process, especially when we are angry. Especially when we are angry at our parents and our parents are pushing us towards the wrong thing. Incorporate this. Be respectful.
That's why I feel in Islam we have the this building of healthier relationship with the between the parent and child. So we have been repeatedly mentioned that we have to be supportive of them. We have to respect them. But I think once we talk about this stuff as Muslims, we all do believe in them.
Exactly.
But once you want to put them into practice, the difficulty starts to just bloom here.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
The problem that most of the teenagers and young people face these days is this. I mean, starting to control ourselves. And I've seen many of them, though they are well-educated, they know how to work with everything, every technological thing, and they are even well-educated in their own majors. I mean, they have high degrees.
Mm-hmm.
But once it comes to anger management or controlling how they feel, they fail.
Yeah.
So this is the place that the teenagers and young people have to be aware of. That
I mean, if you as a teenager, you're good with your peers. When you become angry with your friends, you kind of control it.
Right.
And I can remember we have so many recommendations from the imams and our scholars and so on, that one who overlooks the mistakes of the other, especially this is a saying of Imam Ali, that one who overlooks the mistakes of his friend will die lonely. Now, you're talking about a friend, overlooking the mistakes of your friend. Now, what about overlooking the mistakes of your parents? Now, your friend has not nurtured you, has not given you protection. He's just your friend. Right? But your parent is someone who has sacrificed and has been selfless for you. Yes, there is that generational gap and that expectation, but you should overlook the mistakes of your parents as well. And I can tell you there's so many places that my parents would have done mistakes, and I know that these are mistakes.
Right.
And I know I have this gut feeling that these are mistakes.
It happens. They're not flawless.
Exactly. But then you really can't go against them and disrespect them. You might tell them, Dad, Mom, this is a mistake. Right? And I've done that. And I've also gotten my response, know your place. Yeah, I've gotten that response as well, know your place. But should you disrespect them? No. Keep that, you have that expectation, keep that respect. Tell them wherever you can, amal ma'ruf nahy anil munkar. And I think it's a very good relationship if you have your parents. And I know that for a fact, many instances, my parents would have accepted their mistakes.
Yeah,
oh,
they
yes.
would.
Yeah, and they would, because you see, they're looking at you as someone who... as a version 2 of themselves. They're version 1.0. You're a version 2.0 of themselves. When they look at you, they look at you as if... Well, of course, if they're like, good parents.
Right.
They look at you as if, okay, this is someone who I have nurtured. I have told them this is correct and wrong. And I might do mistakes that I might be overlooking. But since I have brought him up to not overlook this mistake,
right.
He or she will tell me my mistake. And this is a very good relationship, but you should keep it and that relationship and that communication.
We should remind ourselves that this is the way our parents are thinking of us.
Exactly. And that communication, again, respectful. And not the same as your friend, but your expectation should not be more than that either.
Right.
Your friends are human beings, you're human beings, and likewise your parents. And all of them have expectations from each other, and you should overlook the mistakes. And I believe that this bringing down our expectations and accepting the responsibilities and our parents being not infallible is crucial to having a very peaceful, a coherent, and a lovely relationship with our parents.
So I think that's all for today, with the best wishes for all the young people around the world to remember and to remind themselves of the respect that is needed for the parents, and with the wishes of this healthy relationship between all the parents and children. Let's end today's episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day and you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum wa
rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great